So thank you for being here. I feel like she took most of, maybe all of your attention, so there's nothing left for me, but I will try to make it as interesting as I can. So I was originally planning to talk about Bogoliubov excitations and the interplay between topology and interactions, but some people did it first. So during this program, so I think I'm just going to talk about some ongoing work that I've been doing with Torsten here, who is at Station Q. And as you know, the title will be like Exponential Lifetime Improvement in Topological Quantum Memories. So yeah, I'm just going to present you a simple scheme, basically, to prolong the lifetime of topological quantum memories. And that applies to basically any type of stabilizer code in the end of it. So if you don't know what this is, it's fine. But I will present all of it from the point of view of a very simple one, the toric code, which is a toy model for topological quantum memories that was introduced by Kitaev pretty much half of my life ago, or some long time ago. But anyway, so the outline will be like this. I will talk first about, well, the toric code. And I apologize to people from Station Q. I see there's a few of them. So you guys know what this is much better than I do. I hope that it brings back some good memories from the... Yeah.
It's probably in that interview, job interview.
Right. So I'm going to talk about why it is... awesome. And right after, why basically it fails. And then, if I have time, this is like the meat of my talk. I'm gonna tell you how to make it okay-ish. All right. So let's do outline. So toric code. So the toric code is basically a system defined on a square lattice. So you have some kind of lattice like this, and you have this, and you have spins on all of the edges. So now this is my fault. I didn't prepare any slides, so it's going to take time every time I draw this. But yeah. Just relax and enjoy it. So this is like a spin 1/2, right? And I'm gonna put some periodic boundary conditions. This is not really needed, but it makes it simpler. And this is why it makes it like a torus. So this is why there's toric in toric code. All right. And this is pretty much the Hilbert space that we have. And now we can define operators on that space, right? So the operators that I'm going to define, I guess, okay, I have to actually bend. So the operators that you can consider are twofold. So there's one which is the star, so-called star operator, which is defined like that. So A star is a product on all the spins belonging to a star of some sigma x Pauli matrices. And what I mean by a star is just for each of these crossings where you have four spins, that's basically acting on these guys. All right. And then there's a plaquette operator. BP, which is also a product on four spins on some plaquette, this time sigma j z, right? And the plaquette is just one of these squares. So I'm talking about these four spins. All right. So those are the operators on the Hilbert space, and you can see that there are a product of Pauli matrices. So they will have eigenvalues plus and minus one. So now, obviously, I mean, those are all sigma axes, so the stars at different positions, they commute, and the plaquettes commute as well among themselves. But what you can see also is that the plaquette and the stars also commute among themselves. So basically, you have all commuting operators. So this AS, BP, zero, and the others are also zero among themselves. You can see that because they always share, like if you look at this guy and that guy, they always share two spins. So if sigma x and z anti-commute, if you have two of them, it will commute, right? So now you can ask yourself if this is a complete set, right? And you would tend to believe that this is because the number of spins is equal to the number of plaquettes plus the number of stars, right? Because if you look at one unit cell, you have two spins, one plaquette, and one star. So you would tend to think that there is no degree of freedom left. But actually, what happens is that you have two things that hold true. The first one is the product of all star operators is 1, and the product of all plaquette operators is 1. And this is true because it's a torus. So if you keep multiplying all these guys, everything cancels out. You just get 1. Right? So in principle, you get 2 constraints. And those are actually, so there's 4 degrees of freedom. So there's 2 qubits that are left, that are just somewhere in there, hidden, right? And those will be your logical qubits. So the one you use to encode information, right? All right. So, now we have to specify what kind of code we want. So basically, all these operators are specifying some part of the Hilbert space. And you?
Can you explain what that physically means? You do not measure. You do not use. You do not store your qubits in a single spin, but some coherent superposition that's more complicated, which makes it.
I will tell you what kind of operator. Defines a qubit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it cannot be expressed in terms of this. Mm-hmm. So it will be something more, something interesting. So the code that I will choose, the subspace, is defined by AS equal plus 1 and BP equal plus 1. So all eigenvalues of these guys corresponding to plus 1. So basically all states psi such that AS psi equal BP psi equal psi. Right. This is like your subspace. And the memory qubits, so I'm going to tell you exactly what they look like. So I kind of have to, I'm not going to redraw the lattice, but they are essentially like this. So there is one of them that you can define like that, and the other guy like this, let's say. So I'm going to tell you what these are. In green, this is a big sigma x, so this is your qubit operator, and that's a product of all spins along the loop of type 1, which goes around the torus, of the sigma gx operators. And this guy is just similarly product over G belonging to loop of type 2, which goes around in the other direction of the Z operators. So it's not completely obvious, but if you look at these operators and you try to multiply them in any way, you will always get a closed loop on the torus, but not one which you cannot contract. So these two loops are the only two non-contractible loops that you have around the torus. And you don't need to define them like this. I could have defined here or like somewhere else. You can deform these strings. They're all, they just define the same qubit. So those are the two. And it's nice because they are very non-local. So that means that that's the whole point of this, that you have some non-local qubits, which actually turns out to be related to some topology. Okay. So so it's like non-local topological qubits. Right. So now why is it cool? I've told you. The good thing about this, I kind of told you already, is that you have a great protection against errors. And I'm going to show you how this works. So let's say that you focus on sigma x errors, just local bit flips on this lattice. And I'm only going to talk about sigma x errors. You can generalize to any type of sigma that you like. But this will be the one I like. So if you do that, you have three possible effects. And so the first one is, let's say you apply it to, like you have two plaquettes, and you apply it here. At the center, what it does is it will flip basically sigma x anti-commutes with the plaquettes. So it will take a BP equal plus one value to a minus one value. So you will create two defects on these plaquettes, like that. Second thing that you can have is if you already have a defect, then what it will do is just move it. And the last one, I guess, you see it, is just annihilation of the defects. So this is like the three type of events that can happen because of these guys, locally. Okay. So now the good thing is that you can play, you can look at these errors. You don't know how they were created. You don't know what type of bit flips occurred in time previously, but you can measure the value of these plaquettes. So basically, you have a situation where you can actively correct errors. So if you have a lattice, one code, and you have, I don't know, some defect here, I'm just drawing a string to show like the bits that were flipped, but this string doesn't exist. Maybe some other guys like that, and some other guy like this. So you have some density of these guys, typically. And what you can do is just measure the positions of these guys. And then you can bring them back together. And that's pretty easy, right? If I look at this, I know these guys are together, this is two together. I'm not completely sure, but I have a high probability of correcting the errors in that case. So now the problem is, because there's always a catch in this business. The problem is if the pairs separate too much. So decoding that you do, it fails when the pairs separate. And you can see it too much. You can see it easily if you look at just a simple case. You have one error, so it's been created like that. Let's say this is the system size L, and this guy is L over 2. Then, I mean, you look at this and you say which it is. I mean, I can correct it like that. So actually, I did it. You don't see the strings, right? And I can correct it like this. Yeah. All right. And you can see, like, if I recombine these guys by applying flips along this string, I don't get the same as if I apply a string around the opposite side of the torus. So these two guys, they differ by a long string. Right? That's the point. So they differ by a long string, and this long string is just the logical qubit operator. So that's bad, because it means that if you do this or that, you would flip the qubit, basically. You will change the nature of your, you will alter the information that you're trying to protect.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can we ask questions? It's okay.
Yes, yeah.
This has been a bit intense for the non-Q station of us here. So, so if we go back to this, so you define your qubits like this, okay, one and two. Which yep. They go around the space, right? Your arrows are single normal bit flips.
Single
this is what you assume. Single
double
side.
Ones. It doesn't need to be there. Yeah.
So it could be.
It could be longer ranged. So if you have something long range, you can think of creating these guys the longer strings directly.
This is where I started getting lost. What are these guys?
So these are defects. So let's say I apply a sigma x here, I get a pair. This is one of these processes, right? If I apply sigma x here and there, I first create that pair and then I move one. So this is like a combination of this process and that process. So it's just like a configuration where randomly I just apply sigma x.
So I mean, in normal quantum computing, we have bit flips, we have dephasing, and we have three.
Right. So you could have. I'm saying, and I'm just looking at this guy. So you can look at sigma z.
So a bit flip looks like what in your language? What exactly? This is 1, 2, 3.
Bit flip does this. That's the only thing that can happen. If there's nothing, it creates two. Uh-huh. If there's one, it moves it. If there's two, it kills them. So you can guess like what kind of flips I did here. And to correct them, you need to do the same type of moves. You need like to make them back together. Like this line of flip or this line of flips. Okay, and at finite density, it's even worse. So if you look at finite, what you will have is like you can separate into big sectors where you have these errors floating around, and I'm not gonna draw all of them, but the point is that if the size here, typical average spacing between the pairs, becomes larger or comparable to the average interparticle spacing, so this is the density, this is the average spacing between the pairs, and this is the size of the pairs, right? So you can see that this it starts to fail basically when this is satisfied, because the pairs will just start to overlap, and then you will have this huge percolation of a long string, which is what you don't want, right? So just if they start overlapping, you'll have like a long string being created, and that's game over. So the game, and you can see wake up.
So in this first errors that you had, If they're localized and they cross each other, it doesn't matter. As long as they're local, it's fine.
So you
can have like crosses.
You don't see the strings. They don't mean anything.
Yeah.
They actually fluctuate. Whenever we apply these operators, they change. So the goal is to suppress pair separation. And you want to do it passively. Because of course you could look at a very fast in time and every step you look what happens and then you correct fast enough. You can always do that, right? But it's practically not so easy. So the point is to do like engineer something that's stable on its own. So there was some previous ideas to do it. One was to have long-range instructions. So you can imagine that if the effects attack each other, for example, that would help. But the problem of these long-range instructions is that it's hard to make and they're not so stable against perturbations. So that's not necessarily the best. You can also think of this order, which is kind of a natural way. You can think of trapping the defects if you have some random potential. That's also kind of cool, but it only works at zero temperature, and we want to take it to a finite temperature. That's the game. So, because if you have a finite temperature, there's always some thermal activation that can make the defects move on the lattice. So this order is not the best too. You have some other schemes. So this talk, I'm going to talk about driven dissipation. How to use dissipation to help. Okay, so at this point I want to move to a physical system. There's a strong relation between this thing, which is pure like quantum information, and a condensed matter system, which has some topologies and topological properties. So the connection is like this. So you just start with the Gaussian Hamiltonian, which is something like this, factor of two, doesn't matter. So minus j times the sum of all the star operators, minus j over two, sum of all the Black-Hat operators. And what it does, so j is bigger than zero, what it does is you just assign an energy cost to have like b plus one or minus one. So now, if you think about it, what I was telling you, the subspace that we were looking at is just the ground state of this. So the Kluge subspace is the ground state in this picture. And the defects are just the excitations of this Hamiltonian. And those happen to be anions. But that's a different story. I don't really want it. So if you braid them, you get some non-trivial pace. But it's related to the fact that this whole thing is topological. So anyway, I will call them anions. So now you need something that creates the errors. And typically what you will have, so the errors will be like due to some thermal bath. And so the typical toric-Kluge bath coupling that I will look at is just each spin is coupled by a sigma x operator to a sum of bosonic modes with a strength lambda I, like that. And that's really just a spin boson model. It's a the simple thing you can think of, right? And if you do like this usual treatment, Bohr-Markov, you just put this and that, you trace out the bath, you get a master equation, which is pretty simple. You get the probability Pm, the probability to be inside, in a configuration psi m, with energy Em, changes in time as the sum over all configurations of some gamma omega mn pn. So this guy is just a transition rate. From the state psi n to energy pn. And omega mn is just the energy difference. And then you just have like the outgoing rate. So this is just like that. Right. Cool. So it's at this point everything is pretty classical. You just for each of these configurations, you have a transition rate to go to some other configuration. Yeah.
So it does look classical indeed, but why? Why did you throw away the coherences?
The coherences, everything is there. It's just you have a set of commuting operators. They define your subspace. They define anything that's happening there. So these configurations states are just like lattices where I label which packets are occupied. And I can transition from one configuration to the next by one of these three moves. Right? And there's some rate for that. Because now you have an energy cost for these effects, right? So it's just that's what you get.
Question?
Sorry. Yeah.
What is the Bach Hamiltonian? You didn't write anything.
It's just a bunch of frequencies times beta over b. Yeah.
So it's non-interacting.
It's non-interacting. You know what I mean?
Of course, it's interacting with the toricode, but
so everything about the bath is contained in this race.
Okay.
So what? And I'm going to tell you what.
The probability? Can you? This is the probability of what exactly?
This is the probability of having some state, like one lattice with anions in some position, and this, and you have a transition rate to go to some other configuration where the anion, for example, is moved by one.
The eigenstates of your.
Right. The same code space as I was looking at. Yeah.
So I also have a question here. So in principle, I can just integrate out bosons.
Sure.
And that will introduce some local correlation between the sigma operators, sigma x.
Between your sigma.
So is every spin sigma
Because
it's a local bath.
It's a local bath, yeah, exactly. Each spin is coupled like that. But that's true. I mean, you can have a bath which has some finite correlation length. Or even very non-local, and then you
would local in time. In time.
Okay. You don't. It's all contained in these rates.
But I'm not sure even if I can reduce the equation. This equation.
No, you can.
This is just more Markov approximation.
You are
that you get red field, and then you go rotating the approximation.
You are assuming that basically the system does not have any memory, right?
Yeah. There's no back action of the bath. But this
type of thing. And the local interactions in time, which scale is 1 over tau squared, I'm not sure we can actually do it.
This model and the type of race that you get that. There's a paper by Leggett from 87. This is just the spin boson model. So it's actually pretty
Omic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm going to take Omic here. You can take anything you want, so there's also some cutoff.
The question is about this cutoff.
Yeah, so choose it as you please.
Okay, so
it doesn't really matter for what I'm going to tell you. But we can discuss it.
So this is one bar for everybody, all the spins, or each spin looks at his own.
So B is for the full thing is like a sum here over all k's, right?
So B is for everybody.
Sorry for interrupting. So your index m is a many-body eigenstate index m.
That's a
number of m's is
configuration of anion, which is all I have for states in the system. Yeah. So it's a many-body. Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Just one picture like this, one snapshot.
just finish your levels of your
maneuver system.
So actually, I have a question. So at the lowest level, I look at the eigen energies of that Torico.
Yeah.
The lowest level is twofold degenerate. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you have all the other states.
They're also twofold.
Now these rates that you are talking about is between these manifolds.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then since the errors is local, you are not inducing any dephasing within the manifold.
No.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. You couple manifolds by local signals. You can have
some. N is the population in each manifold, basically.
This N is more than the population. It would be like a double index, the number of anions that you have and where they are.
But just to make, there's no quantum memory at finite temperature in Torico.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
if I change my Hamiltonian just a bit. The degeneracy exists only for the ground states, not for the excited states.
I know. So everything about through, what's, even if I add a so far it's like Kitaev's work. It's not even like shouldn't be angry at me. It should be angry.
It's fine. I'm saying if I change your Hamiltonian by adding a magnetic field, sigma x or sigma z, everything works even then. What you're saying. It doesn't matter that you're. If I don't work with this Hamiltonian and consider a more generic Hamiltonian.
Yeah, you can have. It's I'm taking the simple case, so you can have some excitations that are less local. You can have some interaction turns in there. You can have a lot of things, which in the end I don't think they change much of what I'm gonna say. So that's
Well, the labeling will not be this simple then. You can't.
No, for sure. Yeah, that's true.
So then there's like three relevant rates. So I'm taking this type of bath, but
it really doesn't matter. I'm just taking a gnomic bath because that's what people like usually. That's what you typically have because to lower order everything is kind of linear.
So there's three relevant rates which you can guess. So the first one is gamma of 2j, which is the rate for like creating a pair. So this move now, like this move there, cost 2 qj. Then you have a move which doesn't cost you anything, which is the moving one excitation. So that's the diffusion rate, this guy. And then there's the annihilation rate, which obviously is just minus 2j. And that's it. And then you have, it happens to be that in this case, in our case with this, it goes like linear in temperature. And this guy is, because of detailed balance, you will have this relation. So it's exponentially larger than rate fluctuation. So they annihilate very fast. They move kind of fast. As long as you have a finite temperature, there will be diffusion. And you can create them, but only rare events, right? So now why it fails? Well, you can tell, right? At finite temperature, the problem is that there's no free energy barrier against long strings, basically, as the system size increases. So if you increase the system size, it doesn't change much. And you can think of it, if you create one pair, it's very unlikely, but if you have some fluctuation that does it, then these guys can go crazy wherever they want. And they have like a 2D space to do that. So you can think that, entropy always wins. And it wins even better when you increase the size. Which is not what you want. The whole point of a topological thing is if you increase the size, it should be more stable. There it's not. Okay. So, and it's kind of a generic problem in this topological quantum memories. They can go to four dimensions and then it kind of works, but at 3D or less, this is hard to get. So the idea I want to show you is actually very simple.
How much time do you have? In the last 10 minutes.
This is 10 minutes? Right.
Being generous, actually, right?
I think it's fine. Let's not go faster. It's a good speed.
I mean, if you're here on this holiday, that means you're dedicated. So I guess.
I have my blanket and pajamas.
You can do a little ride, but. So it's kind of, I mean, if I stop here, it's kind of not nice. Okay, so the thing I want to do is like make anions sink in energy. And what I mean by that is if you have some excitation, so this is now energy space, and this is space, and normally there's like this thing which is J, the energy cost, so this is E equal to rho. I'm going to do something where with a rate gamma pump, I call it pump, but it's, there's no special reason for that. You will have this thing. So it's now going to sink continuously in time up to a maximum, let's say U, which is smaller than J, because you don't want to have no gap anymore. So each excitation, whenever it's on the thing, on the lattice, is losing continuously energy. And the way you do it is by coupling to some driven dissipative system, which some ancilla on each packet, which I'm good. I can tell you about it. Probably I won't have time, but I can sketch it. But the point is, it does that. There's a rate where you just lose energy. So it moves on the lattice, but it loses energy. Okay.
So and you're damping the anions? Is that a decent picture? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I think of it as like memory foam thing. So. Anions are like they sink, and if they move, slowly it comes back. So actually, there's a rate. That's the next thing. So if you have like no anion anymore, let's say it was killed, then there's a rate gamma decay of the potential trap, let's say, where you can go back to this configuration. Right. So, this is kind of the whole story there. I don't tell you how to do this, but I think I'm talking to you about this system here because it's kind of something you can do with photonic systems, so that's the point. But that's the whole idea.
So how do you create the trend?
How do you
create the
trend?
How do
you what?
Create the trend.
You, sorry?
How do you do it? The question is.
How do you do it? Okay, yeah. Bear with me. I will soon. I just want to sketch the results that this gives you. And then if you want to see more, you just shout. If you don't, then...
Yeah. So this is an extra dissipation channel, because you already have this buff. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the engineered part. Yeah, that's the good part. Yeah.
And your engineered path would be local, right?
Or the engineered path will be local, yeah.
Sure.
Because, yeah, it's complicated if you have something non-local. I mean, it acts on each packet, right? On each effect. It's kind of difficult. Yeah. So the main results. If you just do... The analysis is not completely trivial because you have all these anions and they leave trails behind them and they fall back into it. And you can think it's kind of correlated, right? But it turns out that you can get some results at least. So first, there's an obvious... self-trapping effect. So if you create two guys, they will lose some energy. They get, as they go in time, they get more and more trapped. Right? So obviously, this is gonna favor recombination. This is the thing that will kill entropy in the end, because they just sink together, and then it's more likely to just go towards each other than diffusing away. Right? And actually, the pair separation probability. So you can get very good estimates of them. It scales as a function of the distance between the guys. So typically, they will end up in the same trench, right? They were created in the same trench. They form that trench. So maybe there's a slight bump in between, right? But they will be in some kind of trench. And this probability scales as an exponential of minus L. So it's exponentially small it's exponentially hard to make these things where it's extended by L. And that's good, of course. And this rate, alpha, goes like minus log of alpha up, where alpha up is just the ratio between the rate to overcome this U barrier and the diffusion rate inside the trench. So you can think, and this, and you want this, of course, to be pretty small, right? You want the diffusion to be much faster than the, once in a while they will escape and expand the trench, but most of the time they just diffuse, and the likelihood that they find each other is exponentially good. That's, you like it, or 5 minutes?
Question.
Okay.
Too many questions you asked.
So you make this trench, you already know where the anions are, and then you make the trench?
No, the trench is created by the anions who lose energy. It's not amicable, it's just...
But then we should wait until you make your make the physical implement.
Right. Okay. So, and then the other figure of Mary that you're interested in is the memory time, right? Or the coherence time. And this guy goes like 1 over L squared gamma of 2j. So this is like the rate for pair creation. You can think of like it's gamma 2j locally to create a pair. I have L squared sites, so it's L squared times gamma 2j of creating some pair. And then there's the probability that these pairs separate. Then there's the separation. And it's harmful when it separates by half the system size. And now, like this guy, actually saturates at some L max. So that's the bummer, okay? There's a max. So it goes exponentially, that's super cool, until some L max. And this L max is actually, that's the good thing. It scales like e to the beta j minus u, and there's some other 3, but doesn't matter. And this is like much larger than 1 if you go to a low enough temperature. So you can have a exponential decay to some size you want. You may just make it like large enough for your system, right? Okay. And now if you plug this, like this behavior, just remember that the exponential scaling of this probability, you will have that the maximum coherence time that you get is e to the alpha L max, pretty much. And if you think of that, it's going to be just e to the alpha, e to the beta, g minus u over 3. And this is good, because, this is good, right? Because like you get an exponential of the Arrhenius law that you like. For a single qubit, it would be like this. And now I have exponential of that for this type of memory. So it's like a super Arrhenius, or whatever you want to call it, scaling of the memory time. So it's not perfect, but you get this within some parameter range. And so if there was no Lmax, this is what people call self-correcting. This is actually good self-correction. But this Lmax is bad. But again, like I would call it like practical self-correction or something, because provided you make this bigger than your system size, you don't see any difference. So that's the thing. Okay, so now I should show you some. Right? Okay.
You want the...
Yeah.
Okay.
So, is this working? All right.
No.
Back. All right, so that's the setup, right?
So as I told you, like those are, this is like one snapshot of this system where you have like the onions being in some, they created some trenches. You can see that the steps are not all the same inside. So there's some potential here. You don't see that there's actually like a faint potential remaining because some pair is annihilated. So roughly, the system works like this. So you have like when the packet is occupied by one onion in red. What happens is that you have some Ancilla system pretty much like this, which is driven, and then it has a fast decay rate to 1 and a slow decay rate to 0. So whenever like there's an onion, you fall into resonance here, and you will pump the state 1, right? And when there's no onion, you just go back to 0, but slowly. That's the slow decay rate of these trenches. So whenever you have 1, the 1 is interacting with the plaquette now. There's a Hamiltonian, I can write it for you, but basically this occupation of 1 pushes down the energy of your system. That's pretty simple. You just need like some kind of scheme which allows you to remove entropy from the system, basically, and you get these trenches. Right. So now the reason why it's kind of easy-ish to analyze this is because as you increase the depth of this potential as compared to temperature, that's the relevant parameter, the trenches become more and more one-dimensional, the ones that are relevant. And that's because it costs you this gamma of U, like you have to, whenever you extend the trench, you need to pay energy, right? So this is very, like, a trench like this is very costly. As you go to a deep trench, it becomes more and more unlikely. So you'll have, like, mostly one-dimensional objects, right? And this 1D thing makes it simpler to analyze. So here is the Pearson separation probability versus the for different like strength of this depth, maximum depth that you can get. You can see that when it's 0, well, you get the toroid. So this is the toroid line. It decays. So your lifetime, the separation probability goes down, but very slowly, and you have, as you increase this U over T, you get this huge like exponential increase. Like you can see, like it jumps from like 5 orders of magnitude here. And it's not even like, this is the scheme where we can compute stuff. If you go to bigger U over T, and you do your Monte Carlo simulations, you never get an event. You never get events like that. You never get a separation of 4, because they just like pop in annihilated, because the trench is so deep, right? So these are really tough, actually, like these lines where the scheme works, they take 1 week just to get, because you never get these points. So, right. And here is like versus the pump rate. So if you don't pump is like the memory, how fast you sink, right? This is the rate of pumping this potential. And so if you don't pump it, well, you get again this story code. And if you pump it faster and faster and faster, you get a better and better exponential scaling with of the probability. Like it's more and more unlikely to separate them, as you would expect. Like, and for infinite pump, you just get the same as before here, this line. Okay. So now versus the decay rate, you can think of also like what happens if the decay is too fast. So if the onion moves and the trench goes back directly, it's bad because you lose like track of the other guy, right? So if the decay is 0, you get if the decay is 0, you get this. As the decay increases, you get less and less less good, right? So there's always a critical value for the decay rate. There's a plateau basically as a function of decay, but this plateau can be really really small. Until then, it's exponential. So I'm doing everything I'm showing is in a bad regime where I can do numerics. So it's not very illustrative of the scheme.
And this is good just for a spin flip error, right?
This is all for sigma x local errors, but can be extended in an obvious way. Yeah.
Can you explain again why it saturates? You mentioned.
Yeah, so it saturates here because. Okay. That means you want more time. So basically, the idea. The reason is that when the onions are like this far, let's say you reach that separation, right? If the decay is too fast,
you know, there's nothing that, like the potential in between decays, so in actual life it's more like this. Because the anions are not there, right? So to rebuild the potential, they need to diffuse within the trench. And at some point, the time for the anion, which goes as L squared, the time for diffusing to the other guy becomes too long as compared to the decay, right? So you will create a bond here, which is bigger in the temperature.
Okay, some and kinetics then, of the process.
And then at some point, the trenches, they just split.
Okay, so it's diffusion between the then and there is some barrier, just some potential barrier.
At some point, you cannot diffuse in time to see the other guy.
Yeah.
And the bump will be too big, so now you have two trenches. They are separated, you don't gain anything. Right. So this is this this critical scheme here. All right. And now, like in terms of memory time, that's again like as a function of the depth of this potential. So you can see like this is the toroid. Memory time goes down with the system size. And as you crank up this guy, not that too much, right? Some factors, you lower the temperature or you increase the depth, you go to some exponential scaling. And there's a limit here. This is the L max I was talking to you about. All right. But you can see like this is like five orders of magnitude and it's not, again, it's setting our regime. Like this curve, this particular one, is like 2 weeks, I think, or to take it. So 2 weeks of like running on a cluster to get these events, which almost never happen here. And you can do better if you go to 10. But I don't know. I mean, cannot even prove it, right? So here is versus the pump again. So the pump is pretty not bad, but I mean it changes the scaling quite a bit. So if you don't pump fast enough, like this would be infinite pump here. If you pump a bit less, you get there, but slowly. So you have to increase the system size, whatever. There's still an exponential increase. And the decay, funnily, it doesn't have so much of an effect. So like you can see here, this is for essentially almost no decay. So no decay is bad because if it never decays, at some point there's trenches everywhere. So it's back to the original picture. If you just if everything is in a trench, it's like there's no landscape anymore, right? So this is pretty much the same scaling as the Torikoi. But as you increase the decay, you go very fast to this optimal region. So you can change it by some. This is logarithmic, right? You can change it quite a bit, but you just stay around this exponential regime. And actually, as you increase it, it gets better. And if you increase it too fast, then it gets bad again. All right, this is what it's showing. So I guess this is all. Yeah.
Exhausted.
I don't dare to ask Christian. I know why. You want to go? Okay. So two questions, but actually one. Can you tell us a little bit about the implementation more? I mean,
right,
what you
right.
have in mind? Because I mean, to the non-specialist, onions are very elusive things. Has anybody seen them somewhere recently? Can you update us on that? And how do you plan to couple something so elusive to some other thing? I mean, it's one step further.
Yeah. You need some interaction, which would be between the packet. You need something which...
Five-body.
You need a five-body interaction. Yes.
Five bodies. Already four. No more.
Four is a toroid. So,
yes, so we need five now.
Five, but I told you about the toroid because it's cute. But the stabilizer codes based on two-body interactions. Yeah. So then it would be three-body. So you pick whatever you want.
Three-body.
So two-body is the
two plus
chain.
Three for your.
So this works. This works for the Kitaev chain where you have like spins like that, and your stabilizer is like this.
Yeah.
And each of your stabilizer is a sigma x.
So you want to couple.
So your plaquettes would be the sigma x, sigma x. Your errors would be sigma z. And the same business happens.
So you have something in mind? Is this?
No. I'm just pointing out that if you get some kind of dissipative thing, which doesn't need to be too fast, you get these scalings,
yes.
Which are favorable.
I mean, in terms of model, have you
in terms of model, not, I mean...
System, have you already figured out which system?
No, I haven't done any picking my favorite platform and calculating stuff.
There's
But, yeah, I don't know. So you want us... Yeah. I can tell you what kind of time you need, but... So the placket and CILA interaction that you would need would be like some scaling this U, the depth. Times, yeah, so you can have like the occupation of your level one of the ancilla, plus some other U, let's say it interacts level two, like that, and then times the plaquette. So I'm gonna. So what it does is basically whenever you have an excitation, it shifts the levels out of resonance, and that's all you need, right? And then it vice versa. So if you have like population in one, it shifts the energy of the being. It's kind of a trivial statement
here. Topological contact is not affected by this kind of additional interaction. I mean, the information that's encoded is not affected.
No, you don't know anything about, like, it's not measuring these guys, right? It's just if you have some slight deviation away from this, like for the torque, you will have some extra terms that you can do in perturbation theory, and I don't want to do that. I just want to point out that this direction might be worth it, that's all.
Okay. I have another question, but it's a little bit.
Yeah.
Is your system at zero temperature always? How does it function?
No. It's the point is zero temperature works. This is like Leggett.
Exactly.
So there's a 1/log time. It's good. Zero temperature is completely fine. Now we're getting to finite temperature.
Exactly.
So you need the finite temperature because if you don't have finite temperature, they don't diffuse. Right. Okay.
I know you're not at zero temperature. That's why I'm starting. I'm saying you're not at zero temperature. Right. So if your state is not if your density matrix, which is mixed, if I just look at a density matrix for the toric-cohn part, sure. It won't be pure because of coupling to the part.
Yeah.
As long as you are not, as long as it has some admixture of the excited states of toric-cohn, then the thing that I don't know, it sounds very strange that you can still do braiding and.
No. Well, that's fine. The braiding is fine as long as you include.
No, but. Toric-cohn at that special point, without any additional fields, has a property that even excited states have, for example, topological and time entropy and all those things go through.
Right.
Only when you fine-tune sigma x coefficient, sigma z coefficient to zero. But if I have a general Hamiltonian, toric-cohn plus additional stuff, then at finite energy density states don't have those nice properties. So could it be that? That's why somewhere.
I don't think it changes.
No, his point is that time you reach the states, the lifetime of a memory gets longer with this scheme. He's not arguing that eventually you're going to destroy the information, but the time it takes to destroy gets larger and larger.
But you're still doing the braiding in the ground state manifold somehow.
No, you're not in the ground state. Like you have this. Like this is one snapshot, for example. You're like in this. There's a lot of trajectories, like your density matrix. If you unfold it,
if you're not in the ground state, how can?
And there's a very small probability that one sector will lead to another.
But you can't move things around if there's no gap somehow.
But there's no grading. Like it's just a memory, right? In this case.
Yeah. If one wants to do actual grading or something, then
that's a different story. You will have these errors if they occur when you braid. Will lead to other problems.
It's a toric-cohn, so it's not useful for computation.
No, but you can do the same. Again, my
analogy. Actually.
So what do you do in my analogy?
The same thing. So you would couple. Whenever you have a sigma z here, you flip these two stabilizers, so you create like excitations here and there. Then they would diffuse normally.
Yeah, but that's in spin language. I want to
Yeah. Okay, so in it's hard. For solid state, you're looking after like some solid state implementation or something. I
Well, that's what we have.
That's what you have.
No, this thing, I mean, there is a, you can write it in terms of spins.
Yeah, yeah, this would be right.
The local operators that are in one language are becoming non-local in another language. So it's really important which presentation you're picking.
This is the guy, the stabilizer in Fermionic language. And this guy would be a clinical potential too.
It's like disorder.
Yeah. So this, whenever you have like chemical potential changes, this causes diffusion of these excitations in fermionic language. How you can measure this, coupled to some ancilla in a steady state system.
Okay.
It's me.
Okay. One last question before the marathon stops.
So if it's energetically favorable at the site where an anion is, why doesn't this just create more defects? Because then it would be energetically favorable to have more anions.
Yeah, there's an effect where if it's lower, you have slightly increased probability of creating errors within the trench, because your potential is lower, right? So it's easier to create something inside than outside. But these guys are fine, because whenever you create them inside, they are inside. So whenever two things are created inside, it won't change anything. They will just destroy each other by diffusing within the trench.
But I mean, why don't you just keep creating more trenches if it's energetically favorable to have?
So the blue part is still at finite energy. It's just a little bit lower finite energy than
the
white.
So that's this profile that was in here like this. This is J. This is your gap, and this is U. You don't go deep. If you go past, then you start creating air. You don't want that. Just want to you take a little bit of a gap to your advantage. That's
so this U over T scale that you have, U is bounded.
U is bounded by J, but I mean, the crucial thing is U over T, with as compared to the diffusion rate. The gap doesn't play any, just like the creation rate. But yeah.
So, you want to ask? Okay, well, we can continue. We can continue after thanking you again.